Welcome to the Field Day podcast brought to you by the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. I am your host, Jordan Haywisher, Director of Water Quality and Research with the Ohio Farm Bureau. Today's episode is with Dr. Larry Antosh. He is our resident water quality expert, and we sat down and kind of gave an overview of kind of the landscape of water quality and really set the stage for future episodes and updates on kind of what is going on in terms of terminology, how water moves in and around the lake, you know, nutrient loading, different laws and regulations, all sorts of stuff. So expect some updates throughout the year as the kind of the algal bloom season progresses. And we'll make sure that you're up to date with as much information as humanly possible. Enjoy. All right. So I guess we'll start with who you are, where you've been. Where'd you come from? How long you been here? What do you do? All that good stuff.
All the background, the history of Larry Antosh in 2 seconds. Yes, Larry Antosh, senior director, policy development and environmental policy. Been with Farm Bureau going on 19 years. Be 19 years coming up here in July. Prior to that, I was with the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, Division of Surface Water, managing the Nonpoint Source Program and a lot of the watershed management activities. So from a very much a non-regulatory stand over at the Ohio EPA, which fit in very well with what I've been doing here with Ohio Farm Bureau, dealing with environmental policy and making sure that our members are actively engaged in a lot of these activities that are taking place.
So from my experience here over the last few years, you know, I don't know if you were the first or you're still the only, but you are a rarity in your position around Farm Bureaus, correct? As being a more technical expert instead of maybe, environmental lawyer or things like that.
Yes. I have to give our board all the credit in the world, thinking at their time, well, probably about 20 years ago, thinking that, you know, we needed, Ohio Farm Bureau needed someone on staff with the technical background to be able to engage in these issues of water quality, making sure that policies and positions and legislation and task force reports and all that are really based off of good science and good information, just not that knee-jerk position and knee-jerk reaction to what happens to be the flavor of the day or the crisis of the day.
Yeah, well, the flavor of the day, the year, the season, maybe the decade, maybe the century is it's just water quality in general and ag's influence on water quality. I'd like to start with just level setting on water quality over the last, 4 years and kind of where we've been and, where we've come from in terms of, why we are going to talk about some of the things we're going to talk about today.
Water quality in general in Ohio, basically since about 2010, that was when some of the first some of the photographs were surfacing dealing with harmful algal blooms, blue-green algae, cyanobacteria, however you want to call that. And that was with Grand Lake St. Mary's and the infamous jet ski, the red jet ski in the green water. That became very prominent in the news, mainly because of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria produce toxins, and it becomes an issue for human health and potential concerns that way. After that, a lot of attention, more attention was being placed on across the state, and a lot of attention, again, up into northwest Ohio, into the Lake Erie, western Lake Erie Basin. Started seeing some increases in the algal production, kind of going back to the days of the early 1980s, and we had very successfully addressed the issues back then. Something happened in the mid-1990s to all of a sudden we're seeing a higher amount of dissolved phosphorus entering the system, leading to the harmful algal blooms. So attention mainly has been up in the northwest Ohio, a lot of focus on harmful algal blooms, but we do have water quality issues, water quality concerns across the whole state. The Ohio River had had issues a couple years ago. It was a major algal bloom that ran from essentially the Pennsylvania border through halfway through Indiana. And again, happening at a time when there's a lot of recreational activity going on. Cincinnati was holding the Riverfest. And so these things, unfortunately, tend to happen in the late summer, July, August, when the water warms up. All the nutrients that have been delivered and during the spring runoff are available. Blue-green algae, cyanobacteria, love those conditions, and they tend to flourish.
Yeah, so tell me, you know, we'll focus on Lake Erie just to keep narrowed down on at least one body of water. What, tell us about, you know, what contributes the nutrients to the lake? You know, we obviously know the Ohio side, but overall, what contributes to that lake, and kind of how does it act? How does it cycle through the system of that lake?
Lake Erie is a kind of an interesting situation in that the lake itself can be divided up into three basins: the Western Basin, Central Basin, and the Eastern Basin. A lot of the attention has been focused on the Western Basin, and that's the shallowest area, essentially from where it comes in either the Maumee River or the Detroit River up through the islands. That area, that water tends to circulate and replenish itself relatively quickly, somewhere in the range of like 20 to 30 days. So it has a quick flushing time. But it also, being as shallow as it is, receives the nutrients that it receives and the sediment that gets suspended or deposited can be resuspended and reduced and re-release some of those nutrients. In terms of where it's coming from, approximately 41 to 45% of the total of the annual nutrient load comes down to Detroit River, and the Detroit River is not only just the city of Detroit, it's also Canada and the water flowing in from Lake Huron. The remainder comes from either the Maumee River, the Sandusky River, or the other smaller tributaries coming into the basin itself. What we're seeing is that a majority of those get deposited or transported to the lake. Only takes 3 or 4 storm events. And, you know, as we're seeing these higher intensity, short duration storms, an inch or two, skies opening and flushing off. So you have very much increasing the opportunity for nutrients, for sediment to wash off the, not only from the landscape, but also be resuspended in the stream network and either having stream bank erosion or bed flow or things on that nature getting into the lake itself.
So you talked about rain, you know, and obviously, you know, it's raining today up in the Western Lake Erie Basin area and a little bit in Columbus. How do you think that's contributed? You know, you said since the mid-90s something happened. You know, I know there's a lot of factors in play, but how's the rain or the environment's influence on this subject?
Well, unfortunately, it's the major, one of the major players in the whole situation, and it's one that we have no control over, from the standpoint of if we could program out when we want the rainfall to come and at what amounts and all that, I'd be golden. I could retire and I'd be sitting pretty somewhere. But because of the way that we're seeing these changing rainfall patterns, the fact that we're having cooler temperatures early on, the fact that we're seeing the higher intensity, the skies opening and getting the inch in about 10 minutes or 15 minutes rather than that all-day soaker, that's having a major influence on how much is washing off the landscape and being transported downstream. And because of that, we have to come up with ways of how can we, I don't want to say waterproof the watersheds or the drainage areas or our farms, but those are some of the things that we're looking at. What can we do to slow down the wash-off or the runoff? What can we do to make sure that water is infiltrating, holding up the flow from the drain tiles, all those kinds of things?
So with, you know, you'd mentioned that, you know, 40% or so comes down from the Detroit, you know, so why is such a higher percentage of nutrients going into the lake being kind of attributed to ag? You know, explain, I guess, the loading period or what the timing of when some of those nutrients are delivered.
When they're looking at the projections of how large the algal bloom is or what influences – the production within the Western Lake Erie Basin. They look at the time period from March 1 through essentially the end of July. That time period is when the nutrients that would be coming in or washed off the landscape would have the major influence on leading to the harmful algal growth or the algal blooms that we're seeing in the lake. Because of that, not that attention isn't being placed on the municipal point sources and the combined sewer overflows and the home septic tanks and all those. Those are, I don't want to say continuous, but in the way they are. I mean, a city is continuously treating its wastewater and discharging it into a water body versus the non-point pollution or the land management influence is very much dependent on the rainfall patterns that we're seeing. From the standpoint of, is it a point source, non-point source, or where's the nutrients coming from? A lot of that is dependent upon how the land is utilized or what's happening on the landscape. The Western Lake Erie Basin has a large percentage of that watershed, large percentage of that land use is in agriculture. And so the agricultural land use has an influence on what's washing off the landscape. So because it's one of the larger activities, row crop agriculture, especially crop agriculture, gets the, I don't say the finger pointed at it, but essentially does, gets the finger pointed at it. On top of that, one of the pieces or one of the components that tends to get forgotten about is the fact that we do have internal loading. We have these sinks, these areas that we're trapping nutrients and are slowly releasing them back into the system. We're seeing the stream bank erosion. We're seeing the material, just the sediment in the streams flush and wash out. So there's a lot of that internal loading piece, that system loading, that really isn't happening because of what's on the land. It's because it's what we've been able to trap and keep in place.
Yeah, you know, I've heard you speak before about system lag and legacy phosphorus. I mean, I think that is a big issue that's not being talked about enough. You know, and I've said before, with maybe current farmers, it's not to blame them, but it is their problem. You know, and that problem might be, you know, too many nutrients in ditches and waterways and things that are finally kind of hitting that tipping point. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of the lag to the system and even the role that, you know, legacy phosphorus may play in this issue?
Yes. You have to realize that today we're in the times when people want to see instantaneous results. They want real-time information. They want real-time, changed your management practice yesterday, so why am I not seeing water quality improvements today? We know that natural systems take time to readjust. And from an agricultural watershed, it's not unrealistic to have 10 to 20 years after a management practice is in place to ultimately see what the impact is in the stream system itself. That lag time is one that doesn't get, I don't think there's an appreciation for that lag, for that lag time. Now, what we can do is start monitoring smaller watersheds. And there's some attention now going into, okay, can we look at a smaller tributary and track the management practices, the management changes that are happening in that area, monitor the water quality, and look at changes that way. By the time you get down to the Waterville station in the Maumee, you've got a whole heck of a big watershed to deal with. And to be able to look at changes at that point may not be realistic in the short term. Whereas if we go up into the watershed itself, up into these smaller tributaries and do some monitoring, may be able to track that. But still, that's not going to be an instantaneous change. It's going to be, again, take time for the system to readjust. Now, Mother Nature does a really good job of accepting those changes, but it just takes time.
No, it's a fair point. And in a world where, you know, there's seasonal greenness in the lake, it's tough for to expect patience from some people. But it's a really, really good point to make. So you talk about trying to understand, you know, what's out there on the landscape and doing studies about, you know, what nutrients are coming from where. Can you talk about some of the, you know, the studies and reports that have been out? You know, there's quite a few of them, so I don't know which one you want to start with, but, you know, there's been a lot of reports from you know, different institutions about what's going on in the landscape. Can you talk about some of those?
Yes. Just recently, I say within the past month, there's been three documents that have come out that have been in the news and have been reviewed and looked at. One is every year there's a tributary loading report that comes out. It's work that Heidelberg University from their tributary monitoring and provide that to the Lake Erie Commission to track changes in the tributary of nutrient loads and in the tributaries into Lake Erie. And over time, I mean, you can look at the 5-year moving average and the fact that there appears to be some downward movement in where those numbers are going. But again, all highly dependent upon how much rainfall and how much runoff we have. And you can really see the changes in annual variation because of if it's a wet year or a dry year. Report on that, you know, the takeaway that's come out is that, well, we're not making any difference. We're not seeing a directional change in what those loadings are. Again, kind of hard to do that with the natural variation and the fact that Mother Nature gives us an experiment every year. Mm-hmm. So that one came out and identified, well, maybe we're not doing all the work that we're doing isn't showing up as water quality improvements. The other report that came out was Ohio EPA releases every 2 years what they're calling their mass balance study. And then again, major river basins are trying to partition out how much of the nutrient load is coming from the point sources, the municipalities, and industries that have a permit to discharge under the Federal Clean Water Act, and then the remainder is how much is coming off of what they consider the non-point source or the non-permitted areas. They're trying to make an estimate on the amount that would be coming from home sewage treatment systems, the septic tanks, but then there's the remainder component. This was the second time that the reports come out. They did one 2 years ago. They have 5 years of data, very, very much within the document. They're saying, while we're not seeing any trends, we also don't have enough information, and we haven't monitored long enough. They're saying that they're going to need at least 10 years of evaluation to be able to statistically make a determination as whether or not there's a change or not. So again, another report that's saying that things aren't changing, but in this case, there's a very visible recognition that we need more data, we need more time to be able to track that change and be able to see if it is making a difference. Third report that came out, again, this is called the Integrated Report. Ohio EPA, as part of the Federal Clean Water Act, every 2 years is to do an evaluation of the status of Ohio's water resources, and then also then to look at those that are not meeting their potential, put them on a schedule to develop some kind of a management strategy to bring them into potential. Called the Integrator Report because early on, there's two sections of the Clean Water Act that require 2-year reports. And so they started, rather than having independent reports, combining them together. One was the old 305B report, as someone may recognize that nomenclature, and the other is the 303D report. 305B was essentially the status of the state's resources. 303D was, okay, the ones that are not meeting attend uses, what are we going to do? Do we need to develop a TMDL, total maximum daily load, or just continue on with existing management practices or existing programs to bring that into attention? That report was the first time that Ohio had developed a process to evaluate the open waters of Lake Erie. And so their recommendation is that for recreational purposes, because of the harmful algal blooms and the extent of the algal blooms, that the open waters of Western Lake Erie Basin should be declared impaired. The draft report still going through public review and comment, and then Ohio EPA will take those comments and submit a final report probably sometime in either the end of May or beginning of June, so probably next few weeks.
Yeah, so you said impairment. People who are maybe paying attention to some of the articles or some of the comments that are coming out, I mean, what does that mean?
The impairment is essentially, or if a water body is deemed impaired, Ohio EPA looks at and evaluates water bodies, streams, rivers, lakes, under a multitude of use designations, or how that resource can be used. There's an aquatic life. So are the fish and bugs happy? Are they meeting, or do they have populations? Do they have numbers that they should have given their place on the landscape? If the watershed or if that water body or stream has a public water, public drinking water intake, or if it's designated for public drinking water, they evaluate whether or not it's meeting its potential, whether or not there's nitrate violations, bacterial violations, things on that nature. And then there's also the recreational use. And recreational use, again, primarily more of a bacterial. So do we have, are the waters safe for recreation? If you're going to go in and get sick or potentially get sick, you want to eliminate any exposure to the water or reduce exposure to the water. And that's the one use that Ohio EPA developed a tool on to evaluate the open waters of Lake Erie. Because harmful algal blooms do produce toxins, there is a potential then for health impacts from a recreational standpoint. Because it's not meeting that use, that potential for recreation, it then is declared impaired for that use. Once the water body is listed as impaired, then the next step goes into place as to how do we get it off the list? How do we make it so that we can, from a recreational standpoint, how can we recreate in that water body?
And what are the steps if that happened? I mean, how do you get out of the impairment state?
Impairment state, getting out of it is based off of, again, monitoring to evaluate, and they redo those use attainability assessments or look at, with new data, if there's changes being made. And each time one of these integrated reports come out, there are water bodies that are taken off the list because they've met mm-hmm. their potential because of things that have happened in the watershed.
Another thing that I've seen thrown around, I'm sure other people have seen thrown around, is the watershed in distress. You know, can you explain like where that's come from and kind of how it's being applied to this current situation?
Watershed in distress is a state designation or declaration. It is part of the Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Pollution Abatement Rules, and it's being applied in Ohio in the Grand Lakes St. Mary's watershed. In that situation, farmers in that basin, because of have large amount of livestock, either livestock production or utilization of manure as part of their fertility plans. Farmers in that watershed that utilized or generated manure had to develop a nutrient management plan that was submitted to the state, reviewed, and is being tracked. They also had restrictions on the application of manure during the winter time, and rather than say frozen snow covered ground, it's got specific dates when no manure application can take place. There's some discussion of should that designation be moved into the Western Lake Erie Basin. the current rules that the Department of Agriculture have, there are about seven or so criteria that should be looked at prior to recommendation by the Soil and Water Conservation Commission as making that designation as watershed in distress. The discussion that's taking place is then should Western Lake Erie Basin be a watershed in distress? Because the current rules really look at sediment, manure, or materials attached to sediment, feeling is that probably would not be as appropriate in the Western Lake Erie Basin because about 20% of the nutrients are generated through livestock and the utilization of manures in terms of fertility plants. And so you have a large area, would take a lot of resources on the state to make sure that the nutrient management plans are developed, that they're being follow that they're being reviewed, and so it doesn't seem like under the current rules and regulations that are out there that it would be an appropriate tool for the Western Lake Erie Basin.
Yeah, in a world where government employees are fewer and far between than they used to be, it seems like more of these monitoring and regulatory things that would require people to check up on things is probably not feasible, really, from the way things are set up right now.
Yes, and that's one of the big issues that we have, and even within our Farm Bureau policies is that if something is going to be placed, we have the fertilizer applicator certification program that requires resources. I mean, it's not that for that training and for the follow-up and then the recertification and all that. So the program itself sounds really good, but if you don't have the support structure behind it, it's really hard to move forward with. Same thing with any kind of a conservation program or regulatory program. You need to have the resources in place to go out and to work, be able to work one-on-one, provide that technical assistance for those that may need it. And then also the follow-up in terms of if someone makes a mistake and they need to have that regulatory, some type of a follow-up because of an incident that maybe wasn't right.
So what are some of the ways, that are being used to maybe even determine what's being done on the landscape already? I think not enough work has been done to account for what farmers are already doing conservation-wise. How do we know what's being done or what should be done and where to address the issue?
The $64,000 question. Who's doing what? How many widgets have gone on the landscape? How are we moving the needle? Very important question, something that we need to be able to address and make sure that our members, that the agricultural community, don't feel, I don't say intimidated, but a lot of times we have to make sure that if we're tracking land management practices or changes or conservation areas, that we can disaggregate that and track it more on a watershed basis and not have individual farmers linked to the database. Their comfort level is not, not at the point where we're going in and recording everything they're doing and having that accessible to whoever. But it's very key. We need to be able to track. Right now, we can work with either the NRCS through their conservation programs, how many things went in and where. We can work with our soil and water districts, again, looking at state resources, who's doing what and where. Unfortunately, that doesn't track those individuals that say, I really don't want to deal with a federal or state program. I want to do it on my own, mainly because some of it might be timing.
Mm-hmm.
So you could sign up for an EQIP program or something under the Farm Bill with NRCS. And while you may make it on the list, it may be quite a while before someone can come out and design or help, and you don't want to wait that long. So those individual resources that go in wouldn't be captured by just looking at the readily available or the information available through either federal conservation programs or state conservation programs. We know that a lot of folks utilize technical service providers, or they work with their CCA, Certified Crop Advisor, or they're doing fertility and other management practices through a agribusiness, through their fertilizer dealer. And so that may be an avenue of obtaining some information. But again, it would have to be the client, the farmer would have to sign off to be able to release that information into some data set or database.
Yeah, I mean, that's a slippery situation. You know, obviously, privacy is important, but also, you know, sharing some of that information is a good thing. You know, it's good to see what's actually been going on so that we can maybe, address some things. But it's understandable when privacy can kind of get in the way a little bit.
Yes, and you know, like I say, the whole idea becomes one of at what level can we track it on, or what level do we report it on? Yes, I mean, it would be good to know. We know that there's 4 million acres of cropland in the Western Lake Erie Basin, and by working with certified ag dealers, 4R certified ag dealers, about half of that is covered by the work that they're doing. And so we know that, but if someone says where, we have to go back to those agribusinesses and be able to get that release that information.
Yeah. So is there anything that we've missed or anything you'd like to bring up? I mean, we're going to hopefully give periodic water quality updates, so we'll build on kind of what we've spoke about today. But is there anything that you can think of?
Well, I think one of the things that has come out, and this was a report that came out of the International Joint Commission looking at fertilizer use within the Western Lake Erie Basin. And what we're seeing over time is that the fertilizer inputs have been dropping or declining. We're at the point where we're probably putting on less nutrients than are being taken off by the crops that are growing. So we're, in a way, I don't want to say mining the soil, but in a way, you almost can say we are. The nutrients are in the soil being utilized. So that's, I think, a positive. The other piece that came out of that study was starting to look at some of these. You know, we've done a very good job putting in waterways or buffers or field borders to trap sediment and trap nutrients to keep that from getting into our waterways and into our streams and rivers and ditches and things. What's happening, at least the feeling, is that these areas now, because we're not harvesting the material, become, while they were good traps, now they're becoming sources of nutrients. And we need to start looking at, or probably need to start looking at, what are the unintended consequences of our previous conservation practices? And what can we do to draw down or reduce the nutrient loss from those areas? Looking at maybe, and I hate to, not going to pick on any particular type of vegetation, but some type of vegetation, grasses or whatever, that could be harvested out of the buffers. So not only are they trapping, and if you're harvesting and being able to utilize that vegetation, then you're also then removing some of those nutrients out of that area. That, again, a very, very positive report in terms of fertilizer use, and also identifying some things that we may not have control over, just because of it's a unintended consequence of some of our earlier conservation practices. The other piece that came out is probably about a year or so ago, but again, this is a Natural Resource Conservation Service study looking at the Maumee River Basin and really getting into that, what's happening from the edge of the field down to the lake itself. We can put in and can document the conservation practices that, that does or can reduce the nutrient loss, sediment loss, at the edge of our farm fields by 40% or so. If you take those same practices and then look at what the impact is through a modeling exercise through the whole river basin, the amount that's being reduced as you get to the lake is probably about 20% or so. So even though we're doing a fantastic job controlling what we need to control or doing what we can to control nutrient loss and managing nutrients on the, at the farm level, that whole natural system, the lag time, the internal loadings and all that show up, or it's going to take time to show up in the at that last monitoring station before getting into the lake. We have to do a better job on explaining and getting that fact that that lag time, that response time is not instantaneous. And as much as folks don't want to say or wait 20 years to see a difference, that's going to be, unfortunately, the reality.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, the education of farmers has gone up. Fertilizer use has seemingly leveled out or gone down. Soil test levels have gone down. And so really, you know, we talked about the influence of rain, the influence of the lag and legacy of phosphorus. You know, really, it really is interesting to see those things work almost against each other, but that very well could be the thing that's kind of pushing us over the top right now. And I don't want to, you know, I'm always hesitant to say, hey, it's something else, but you know, it in concert with improving conservation efforts on farm, understanding that the lag and legacy is extremely important. And then also the water quantity part of it all, trying to keep things from totally rushing off the field.
That's right, and we can, and the data shows that you can have majority of your nutrient transport by on three or four rain events. So for the majority of the time, our farmers, our members are doing, can be golden. I mean, what they're doing is everything that they should be doing. Looks good, feels good. They're productive in terms of being able to have the crops that they want, and they're and sustainable and all that. And then you get that 1-2-inch rain event, and you get 50%, 60% of the nutrient loss in that one event.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. I mean, I think, you know, even just anecdotally, you can observe that there's more rain events happening there, so the severity is increased, but even just statistically, if you look at the weather stations around some parts of Ohio, you're getting, you know, 50, 60, 70% increase in 1 inch or more rains, or you know, those 1.5, 2-inch rains that are happening way more often than they used to.
Yeah, and then how do we address that? So that becomes our challenge. If that's becoming the norm, then what can we do to change our conservation practices? What can we do to change our farming system to be able to address that and still be able to produce the food that we want and need and maintain the lifestyle that everyone likes?
Yeah, we'll just become a rice growing state if we could get the heat.
Yeah, we could do that. You know, wild rice, we'll just go into wild rice. That's one of my wild ideas back when, is that let's go back to wild rice in the Maumee River Basin and make it an agritourism.
Yeah.
Like in Minnesota, you have to come out and have your certain kind of boat to harvest your wild rice. So it's just major agritourism.
Yeah. You got to pick, your own rice.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, I think that's all I got for you today, but hopefully you guys will hear more from Dr. Antosh on further updates as kind of the summer water quality season rolls on, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, Jordan.
And that was Dr. Larry Antosh from the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. If you want to learn more about Farm Bureau, please visit ofbf.org. Or if you want to learn more about one of our big nutrient management and water quality projects, please visit blancharddemofarms.org. Thank you.